There will come a time for all of us, if we're lucky, when we will feel inclined to bid farewell to our worries, our loved ones, and the loons who we share our home with. It seems far away until it's not, and suddenly one is forced to reckon with all the choices made that cannot be unmade. Like the choice to settle for mediocre coffee your whole life. Do you really want to spend your reflections answering for the choice to settle for something that's just okay, when you could have decided to make each day here on Earth just a little bit better? Don't let this regret plague you to the end of your days. Switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They have blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug custom roasts their beans when you order it so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it or take advantage of their autopilot set it and forget it delivery to outsmart your most forgetful tendencies. And right now, Sparkplug is offering a 10% discount to Top 100 listeners if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word. It applies to any size coffee order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey, you old movie fogies, and thanks a lot for dancing your fingers across that download button to hear the next 129 project. We're the Monday podcasters who review film classics, a venture that started by covering all the titles on AFI's 100 Years, 100 Movies series, the 98 and 2007 editions. You can find every one of those episodes in our back catalog. And here's your early warning that we spoil the pictures we talk about. I'm the old poop who likes to suck face, Ryan Ellis. And here's the saucy peacemaker who enjoys a rousing game of Parcheesi, my wife Bev.
And that's me.
All right, so some business before we get into the On Golden Pond podcast. This episode is dedicated to Fox, our loyal dog of many years and supporting player in all of our podcasts. In fact, I don't think we've ever recorded an episode where he wasn't present until today.
Until today.
Maybe the Shallows podcast we did outside in our backyard. He might not have been part of that, but he was in our lives at least. Every other time he was in the room, or the house at least. The little orange toy lover got really sick in recent months, and we had to put him down on November 12th. So we miss him terribly, we'll love him forever, but our family is down to three, and Sam is going to have to perform all mascot duties on his own now. I don't think he's up to it, because he seems pretty tired. Although he's tired even when he's had 12 straight hours of sleep.
Yeah, well, what's it to you?
On a much brighter note, this is the 275th episode that Bev and I have recorded.
Finally, I can just say 275 episodes instead of dancing around it.
Well, unlike most podcasts, there has to be provisos on this because I've done 12 Scoring at the Movies episodes with Chris and one episode of Ryan Rambles years ago. So we're only 13 away from 300 total podcasts that you can find on this channel. But for the 275th time, it's Bev and Ryan. That also includes three Citizen Kane podcasts. We did two parts, and then I did that recut earlier year. Plus the intro and the extra and various now playings and not 100s, all that stuff. They're all online, either on Apple Podcasts or our website, top100project.com. Okay, the business is out of the way. The coming attractions trivia for this week's picture on Golden Pond. Only one other movie made these four specific American Film Institute lists. The top 100 cheers, the top 25 music scores, the top 100 quotes, and the top 100 passions. Maybe the other movie made more than that, but at least made those four. Name that one other motion picture.
It is Gone with the Wind.
That's right, which outranked On Golden Pond in all four of those categories.
I was sure it was going to be Casablanca, but it didn't land on the scores list.
I happened to watch Casablanca last night, so I looked up my old files for it, just out of curiosity of all the AFI lists. And of course, it's number one or number two or three or ten on almost everything. And it had six quotes. Gone with the Wind had, I think, two. On Golden Pond only has one.
I recently was having a conversation with a friend of ours who wants to take up screenwriting. And I gave her a good admonishing because she had never seen Casablanca. Not admonishing.
Oh, thank God.
But just a very, very strong recommendation that if there's one classic movie you've got to see right away, because she doesn't really see that many, it's Casablanca, one of the greatest screenplays ever written.
And a pretty fun movie. Sometimes the great movies, and we are covering one next week, are films you probably can't recommend to the average person, even those who say they're movie fans. But Casablanca, Yeah. If you don't like that, then you don't like movies.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like homework at all. And it's one of those movies that when it's on TV, it's really hard to turn away. You kind of just want to watch the whole thing.
That's why I watched it, because a few days ago it was on TMN up here in Toronto, TMN. Saw maybe 10 minutes of it. I thought, I got to watch that late last night. Okay, On Golden Pond was nominated for the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists, but of course it didn't make those lists. It made the other ones we just talked about. After a premiere to qualify for the Oscars in December 1981, the picture was released by Universal in February 1982. And since it is so old, Bev, you probably should remind people what it's about with The Skinny.
Henry Fonda and Katharine Hepburn are Norman and Ethel Thayer, an elderly couple settling into their New England summer home on Golden Pond. Their grown daughter, Chelsea, played by Jane Fonda, visits and leaves behind her boyfriend's teenage son, Billy, for the summer. What starts as a contentious arrangement grows into a welcome bond between Billy and the rapidly aging Norman.
Norman Thayer Jr. Or, in a nutshell, ex-educator teams with pubescent stranger to capture and murder a fish.
But they couldn't go through with it.
They do capture him, but they do not kill him. Old Walter, metaphorically, might as well be Norman himself, and they let him go. All right, some more numbers. We're going to talk about a lot of numbers in this podcast. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 92% of them like the movie, 24 fresh, only 2 rotten, and 87% of audiences. This movie was also a surprisingly monster hit. It was second at the 1981 U.S. box office, although almost $100 million behind Raiders of the Lost Ark. But still, it was a huge hit. It's 180th on Box Office Mojo's top 300 adjusted for inflation, just ahead of a few Harry Potter sequels. Wow. That's how big a hit it was. So last week we had a Chuck It All movie in Lost in America. Now it's a Chuck It for the Summer movie, which they've been doing for many decades, these two. What did you think of, in your first viewing, I believe, on Golden Pond?
Yeah, this is the first time I've ever seen it. On paper, this is a movie I should hate. Mm-hmm. It's a precocious teenager won over by a curmudgeonly old coot, thereby healing the lifelong rift between him and his adult daughter, cue the symphony. But against the odds, I loved it. I can't put my finger on what it is exactly that the film does right, but it just walks that tightrope and manages to be heartwarming without being cloying.
I think it's partly the performance by Henry Fonda and Katharine Hepburn, and then later on Jane Fonda. Well, early, and then later on with Jane Fonda. All those things you talked about do happen in ways in this movie, including going right at the line of being cloying. But maybe it's the language. This movie never says fuck, but they do say bullshit and goddamn a lot. It's a film, like you said, we should take a drink every time they say On Golden Pond.
Yes.
Well, also, if they say bullshit and goddamn, take a drink, and you'll be sauced long before Jane Fonda comes back at the end of the movie.
I was trying to put my finger on how the movie does it. The main relationship that's really the most heartwarming is the relationship between Billy and Norman. They kind of start out reticent towards each other and then end up loving and needing each other by the end of the summer. And you're so relieved that they find this catharsis. There's not really any complicated writing in that. The conflicts do kind of seem a little contrived, and it is actually corny. And I was like, why isn't that annoying? Why does it work so well on me? And I think it's because in every other relationship, there's a lot of edge. There is edge between his relationship with Ethel. There's definitely edge between him and Chelsea.
Also with Bill Ray.
Yeah, very much Bill Ray, who's not the lovable, supportable character that a lot of movies would make him. Mm. He's just, you know, getting a good ribbing from his girlfriend's dad. No, you kind of suspect that he might be a bad dude. You aren't really meant to feel happy when you discover that they got married on their own in Europe.
Chelsea married badly before.
Yeah, that's right. Every other relationship has this very real tone to it. It has real, believable problems. And like you say, they speak in real language. They use swear words the way people do. So there's all this corniness, but there's so much authenticity everywhere else that you can kind of give in and indulge in enjoying the heartwarming corniness that does happen.
Even things like the pet name that Billy Ray and Norman have for each other, which is Turkey. It's not like it's Buddy, which is what I call the dogs, and I do mean it with a... But I also call them dopes.
Oh, you also call them monkeys, or...
Right.
I don't know.
Monkey and Chunky. Sam's a little heavy, so we call him Chunky.
I think it's actually kind of endearing, Turkey. It feels authentic because it is this unique word and not Champ or Buddy.
Or Sport.
Yeah.
So the film was shot in New Hampshire in the summer and early fall of 1980, but it's set in Maine. That's where it's supposed to take place. And the storyline, of course, is the battling Fondas. And Art imitated life with the Fondas because Henry had a difficult relationship with his kids, Jane and Peter. He had a third kid. I didn't look up what that kid's name is, but he had three kids in total. And I didn't know for sure after the movie was over, when I talked to you about this, if Jane and Peter were from the same mother, but they are. Henry was married a lot of times, and apparently he was a philanderer. He's a very complicated character, just like Jimmy Stewart. The more you read about Jimmy Stewart, the less I like him. I don't want to read much more about it because he was a hardcore right winger, and that's not the end of the world now. It certainly wasn't many years ago. But he was the kind of guy that tailed people who were supposed maybe communists. He was like John Wayne, he just wasn't as public about it. Henry Fonda, though, was a devout liberal. They were really good friends, and apparently they had an argument about politics. I think it was during the Red Scare stuff, because Henry Fonda was blacklisted, or at least graylisted. He didn't work for a few years there, and he was on Broadway. I don't know if you blame Jimmy Stewart for that, but they had a complicated relationship, and Henry had a complicated relationship with a lot of people he knew, including his kids, of course. He won his only competitive Oscar in this film. He won an honorary award the year before, so they didn't know he was going to win. It's like Paul Newman won an award. I think it might have been the Herschelt Humanitarian Award the year before he won for Color of Money. If they'd known, they maybe would have held off. They maybe wouldn't have given Tom Hanks an Oscar for Philadelphia if they'd known Forrest Gump was coming up the very next year. But you can't predict these things. But Henry, we've covered him in Grapes of Wrath and 12 Angry Men, two AFI films. This probably isn't his best performance, but what did you think of the three? I don't think we've covered anything else he's been in. What do you think of those three so far? Grapes, Men, and now this one. Those three performances are very different as well.
Well, I would say Grapes of Wrath and 12 Angry Men, I think, have a lot more similarities.
They do, but he's a lot older in 12 Angry Men. He's more of a grown man. In Grapes of Wrath, he's supposed to be a young kid. He's not that young.
But I can see Tom Joad growing up to become juror number 7. I can't remember.
8.
There's like some continuity there. But I couldn't see either of those characters growing up and becoming Norman Thayer.
The funny thing is that for the liberal Fonda, and this character seems liberal-ish at least, kind of like Spencer Tracy was supposed to be in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, despite the fact that you have a black boyfriend. Well, how liberal are you? And yet there's a part in the movie, well, midway through, or certainly before Jane Fonda and Dabney Coleman leave for the rest of the film, or most of the rest of the film, where he's hacking on lesbians, just for the sake of them being lesbians. So he has an issue with them for some irrational reason.
Well, irrational, he's a man in his 80s in 1981, so definitely par for the times.
I guess that's true. We've talked about that a few times lately, how things have changed so fast in the last 15 or 20 years about what's acceptable and what's not. Words you can use and things you can say in film and just in life. So we'll talk more about the two Fonda struggles a little later on, but I want to talk about the two main stars. Fonda and Hepburn had supposedly never met before this movie, despite their long careers. How is that possible?
This seems so unlikely.
It seems like it's not true.
You didn't meet at an Oscars
party? Or, right, the Oscars party. Henry went at least, I think he went for the Grapes of Wrath and 12 Angry Men nominations. He was only ever nominated, by the way, for Grapes of Wrath, Best Actor, producing 12 Angry Men, then he won an honorary award. And then this one, he wasn't at the ceremony because he was sick, and Jane accepted for him, gave a great speech. I'll definitely put that on the website along with the other speeches, although Kate wasn't there either. She didn't accept her award. She never went to the Oscars when she won awards. But anyway, so these two supposedly never met, but there was that nice touch where Hepburn gave Fonda Spencer Tracy's brown hat. And when they come in at the beginning of the film from their winter home, I guess New York, where the hell they're supposed to be from, he's wearing that. Then he puts on his fishing hat the rest of the movie. He was very touched by that, apparently, too. It's almost like, oh, you gave me Spencer's hat. And I guess she meant to keep, not just for the sake of wearing it for one opening scene. So what did you think of the two of them together? I guess that's the key in the movie, because even though Henry Fonda has a ton of screen time with Doug McKeon as Billy, and a fair amount with Jane Fonda at the beginning and certainly at the end, and he has that one scene with Dabney Coleman where it's just the two of them for a while there. Great example of the old, so, when you meet the parents, or at least the father of the woman you're stripping and will soon marry. But what did you think of the two older people in these big roles? They both won the Oscar for lead performance. That doesn't happen all that often in Oscar history. We've talked about As Good As It Gets in a recent podcast, just randomly, that one for actor and actress. But these two, were they worthy? She'd won 3 times before. He never had. But they're good together. Anyway, what are your thoughts?
Well, I don't know what the other contenders were that year, so I can't necessarily compare performances. I found he laid it on a little bit thick. Old school Hollywood acting. Katharine Hepburn, I just love always. She's quite believable and natural. She finds a way to lay it on thick without seeming like an actor. Whereas him, it's like you see the strings a little bit. But, you know, the whole point of the movie like this isn't necessarily to have the world's most natural performance. It's to emotionally engage the audience, which he really does. I mean, Norman is in many ways a detestable character. He's an asshole. Maybe he's covering for shyness or depression, but it's kind of irrelevant when you consider what he puts all the people around him through, and we very much see the effect of his curmudgeoniness on his daughter and son-in-law, on Billy and on Ethel. And Ethel, who does a very convincing performance of somebody who's been putting up with someone like him for the vast majority of her life.
So maybe Henry was playing himself on screen more than he ever had before, when he was always this upstanding dude that people said, that's who I want to be. Cary Grant said that he wished he was Cary Grant. Because, of course, his name isn't actually Cary Grant. It's Archibald Leach. And he wasn't the guy we saw on screen, as we've heard many times, including the fact, I've heard again recently, that he may have been at least bisexual. And he never played that on screen. Henry was probably not this upstanding liberal person. Well, he was liberal, I guess, but he was not this upstanding moral fiber, I'm going to treat everybody great kind of guy like he usually was in the movies, like in Grapes of Wrath. We just talked about the way he was with his kids. Very distant. I read a quote on the IMDb where he said, I didn't raise my kids very well at all. I don't know if he was in their life that much. I'm not sure if that's true, but he said, whatever success they've attained is not because of me. He didn't take any credit for it. It's one thing not to take a lot. He didn't take any. And his daughter is one of the most talented women who's ever been in the business. She's barely acted since the mid-80s, I guess it was. She didn't make a movie for 15 years. Between 1990 and 2005, she came back for Monster in Law with Jennifer Lopez, and that wasn't very good. She's been a lot more active since in TV shows and sometimes in movies as well. Also a beauty, but a bona fide talent. Great example of somebody who may have gotten by in her last name. Maybe Peter did too. Maybe Bridget has since. But all of those people are talented anyway. Jane would have made it, I think, regardless. And in the 60s especially, one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen on screen.
In the 80s.
Still look great.
You know what? In 2018, because I watched Grace and Frankie, she's still, of course she looks, well, she doesn't look her age. She's in her 80s. She definitely looks like an older woman now, but she's still a knockout. Grace and posture, and she still is beautiful. It's incredible.
She won Oscars for Clued and Coming Home in the 70s, and she was a controversial figure in the 70s as well. She's not talked about often enough for some of the great actresses. When the AFI did their greatest actors of all time thing, probably the worst list they ever did, simply for this reason. They limited it to people who were not alive anymore or who started their career before 1950. Brando barely made that cut.
Yeah.
How do you have a list without Paul Newman, Jack Nicholson, Jane Fonda? I could name another 50 actors who weren't even eligible to make that list. It's absurd. Jane Fonda should certainly have been on the actresses list. I was looking at it again recently. There's not a lot of actresses that I think are the greatest of all time. She's in the top 10, I would say.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
And she gives a very strong performance, probably the most naturalistic of the three main characters. Hell, Doug McKeon gives a pretty naturalistic performance as a kid. He was only in 11, or has only been in 11 movies, including just recently LBJ for Rob Reiner. So he's still acting. He's done a lot of TV, at least. We're going to see a good kid performance next week in Bicycle Thieves, a young kid, an amateur. I know you liked Doug McKeon, but what do you think? Strong performance here from an actor that hasn't really taken off the way he maybe could have and should have.
I would make the same complaint I made about Henry Fonda, that his...
A little too much?
A little too much. It's but a little over-affectation. I still think he was wonderful. His vulnerability comes through loud and clear, and that's the most important thing, that you have to root for this kid. When he gets dropped off there, can you imagine if you're taken away from your mom? They never, wisely, never explain what happened with Billy's mother.
It's not good.
You know it's bad, because he threatens to send him back to his mother, and that's a threat that scares him.
Bill Ray has been an absentee dad himself, and the way to fix that is ditch the kid for the summer.
Right. So this is a kid who's lost his mother in some significant way, and whose father immediately ditches him with these two total strangers that aren't even genetically related to him. This kid is just out there twisting in the wind. He's incredibly vulnerable, so it's such a relief to see him bond with Norman. I think he plays that well without overdoing it. I just don't think he was the most natural of actors. So I shouldn't say that he overdoes it. He just seems a little bit actorly.
Maybe he was imitating his famous co-star.
Yeah, maybe. They definitely play well together. They have a really convincing performance together. It's cathartic to see him go through his arc of simply just coming around to living on Golden Pond with them for the summer.
He's 13. He's going through puberty in a big way. He talks about things like sucking face. He's never kissed a girl
obviously
in his life. And he's dealing with somebody who's 67 years older than him. They're both juniors, though. That's a nice touch. Bill Ray Jr., Billy Ray.
Oh, yeah.
And then Norman Thayer Jr. The key scene for Billy Ray is when he takes the boat out by himself. Now, not against their wishes. He asks them if he can take it, which is a nice touch. A lot of movies like this coming-of-age kind of thing would have had he takes the boat out by himself and either something bad happens or they don't find out and he does something he should have gotten in trouble for. But they know he's going to take the boat. And he's riding around, a little musical montage kind of thing. He's doing donuts effectively in the water. Wheelies almost.
Boaties.
Boaties. And he's having a good time. He's enjoying himself. From that point on, he and Norman bond. He tries to bond more for sure. Norman is a little bit slower to warm to him, I would say. But then there is that scene, I think it's before that, where it's, we're going to go out and fishing or whatever it is on the lake. You're welcome to come with us if you want to. And if you don't want to, that's your problem. Effectively, is what he's saying to the kid. And Ethel doesn't say anything. Ethel doesn't overrule Norman very often in that house. But in a lot of ways, she's really in charge. She drives them up there when they first get there. She's the one who's driving the car. She drives the boat to town the first time. Then it's, I'll drive home. I'm still a man kind of thing. But obviously, she has to handle a lot of things in their life. She probably drives them around when they're back home all the time because he is getting to be senile. And he's obviously getting close to death. So this is the kind of guy who's going to take longer to bond with somebody with Billy. But once Billy does that boat thing, it's almost like he's in now. I love being on Golden Pond.
That's kind of the point where you can tell that they're comfortable with him. They aren't trying to suss him out anymore. They know what kind of kid he is, and they've decided to do what's good for him. There's very little actual conflict with Billy. There's certainly conflict with the other characters, but that's another exception with their relationship, is things that should and could go wrong, and in other movies you're waiting for, exactly as you say, he should be sneaking out with the boat, make a mistake, and then he has to get in trouble and they have to forgive him in this very formulaic way. But all those things that seem like a setup for something bad to happen just seem to go just fine.
Reminds me of Boyhood.
Yes! I was thinking the
in this
exact
way,
same
two
thing.
Scenes in that movie that many people talked about. Richard Linklater certainly talked about this. One where the main kid is driving with his girlfriend and she's showing him, I think it's pictures on her phone.
Yeah.
And he's looking at it, not staring at it, but looking at it for a little bit too long. Everyone, apparently, and I had this thought too, there's going to be a car accident. It's going to be a big plot moment. No.
Yeah,
it's just, we all do that. We all look away sometimes in a car and we survive many, many, many times. It's not that often that people have car accidents when they're not paying attention, because we all do that at some point. Look at the radio, whatever. The other moments when they're playing with those...
throwing stars or bike gears or something. I don't know.
No, it's,
like,
what do you call it? Table saw kind of thing.
Table saw, yeah.
But just the actual
saw
piece, the actual
they're
sober...
They're like throwing them.
Looks like
sticking
a shooting
in the wall.
Looks like a karate star.
Yeah, they were in an abandoned construction site or
and
something.
And nothing bad happens, but everyone thinks there's going to be a plot point.
I remember that. I tensed up. The whole audience was just waiting.
But Boyhood's not about that. There's not really a plot in that movie. And there's not really a plot in this movie. And it isn't about something bad happening in the boat. Now, there is something bad that happens in the boat later on. So that's a plot thing, I guess, when they're trying to find Norman. And Billy guns it. Nice touch, by the way. Usually in reality or in movies, it's the old person, the one who's going senile, in fact, who guns it rather than hitting the brakes. But it's Billy who does that and then knocks Norman off. And they barely survive. Why Billy almost drowns when they're both in the water, I don't know.
I don't know why they couldn't just swim to shore. You're chilling in the water. Just...
Norman, I get, because he's old and he's barely hanging on to life as it is. And he just had a nasty, not really a fall, I guess. Well, it's a fall, but he hit the water. He didn't hit a rock or anything. His head is cut, though. He must have hit something.
Okay, so maybe that's it. So maybe Billy's... Okay, I forgot about that.
But still, when he catches up to Norman, who's hanging onto a rock, he slips off. And it looks like if Norman wasn't paying attention, he grabs him, pulls him up. Billy, get out of the water. Then Billy would have drowned. Why?
As someone who grew up with a cottage on a lake very much like Golden Pond, yeah, there were rocks. But it's not like a rock touches your boat and then... you immediately go down. Boats are much more sturdy than that.
Well, Billy does gun it, and they hit a pretty big rock.
They had to, like, jury-rig the boat because boats are too tough to just get...
And that
you'll
one just
scratch
did...
it. You'll dent it.
That one did nothing. It bounced off the rock.
Yeah, yeah. That boat was too well-built to get smashed up like that, so they had to make a breakout piece so that it would hit the rock and get a big hole in it. But trust me, I rammed plenty of boats into plenty of rocks not knowing what the hell I was doing in a boat, and you scratched it.
Right. Reminds me of Deliverance when the canoes get upturned and they lose one of the guys and falls in the water and everything. The wooden boat is cracked in half and is gone, but the metal one looks like it's completely fine. That's the one they use to survive.
Yeah, and most boats are made out of fiberglass. They're incredibly durable.
That's the plottiest moment in this movie, though.
It's another one of those things where it's a conflict, but it's barely a conflict. You know they're going to be okay.
This movie does set up more than once, though, that Norman might die during the story.
Very much.
Two fake outs. One is that. The other one is right at the very end when he has his angina attack. Ethel, Ethel, what is it, Norman? And then one of the reasons why this movie works, I think, is he keeps on saying, Ethel, Norman, what is it? She's getting mad at him now. He might be on the brink of death and she's getting tired of him not actually telling her what's wrong. But then not only is he fine, he does take the nitroglycerin, so I guess that helps. He's fully fine. He gets up, they go to the edge of the pond, movie ends. He seems like he's going to be completely okay, even though he's talking about death so much. Now, maybe his mental faculties are going to be better because he's made up with his daughter and he's found this kid to bond with in the future who's going to be his grandson, effectively, his step-grandson. But physically, he was so close to death more than once in this movie. And this isn't a death thing, but early on when he goes looking for, what is it, strawberries and he gets lost, reminding me so much of a time. I was a kid when it happened. He's 80. I got lost in an apartment staircase. I was so young, I don't know why this was such a big freakout to me. I forgot what floor everyone was. My cousin fell or something. He went back to the apartment, have his mom patch him up kind of thing. And I had to go get his toy gun, and I didn't know where I was. And I remember crying. Where did they go? What happened?
It's scary.
Anyway, it's embarrassing looking back on it, thinking, why didn't I figure out we're on the whatever, fifth floor or something, and then just knock on every door at the very least. But Norm is in the same boat. Now, he knows where he is. I didn't. I'd never been in that building before. But he's been out in those woods many times over the years. But that's the same kind of idea where I shouldn't be lost. I shouldn't be terrified, but I am.
I think most people can relate to an experience like that. But what's different with Norman is that not only does he have to deal with the fear of being lost, but he has to accept that the reason he's lost is because he's starting to go senile. He's facing something that's way scarier than getting lost in an apartment building or getting lost in the woods near your cottage.
Or maybe even dying. Is losing your mind.
Yeah, that is dying. That angina, and she says, oh, this is the first time I ever really imagined what it would be like to lose you. Well, she's going to lose him. It seems pretty clear to me that Norman doesn't have very long to live. This is the end of his life. It's part of the reason why Chelsea makes up with him. And it's a rare movie that really, I think, sheds light on the end of life like this. Movies never think twice about showing a young soldier get shot to ribbons or like a young woman get killed by a serial killer. There's all these kinds of death that feel very distant from us that we don't mind looking at. But I think it's an uncomfortable topic for most people because someday we'll be the ones who will get lost in our own front yard. And sometimes it can be hard to watch that.
With global warming, we're not going to live to see 80 years old.
Well, we might, but we may wish that we didn't.
And it's art imitating life again because Henry didn't live much longer after this movie. It was his very last film. What a way to go out.
Great way to, yeah.
And Jane had to accept the Oscar for him because he was home in bed. He lived a little bit longer after that show, I believe. So he saw it, and he was still cogent enough to realize, hey, I won the Oscar. That's great. But she had to make her peace with her father. And I think it was through this movie. Peter later on said, I was cool with that. That movie wasn't anything to do with me. Because they wanted to have Peter in it, too. Jane did. This is Jane's project.
Mm-hmm.
She's not a producer on it, but Bruce Gilbert, who was the producer, produced 9 to 5, and was an associate on Coming Home and an executive producer on The China Syndrome. Those are all Jane Fonda movies.
And she optioned the play. Right. Specifically so that her father
and Jimmy Stewart wanted to play the character, but she beat him to the punch. So this is effectively her project. She probably should have been a producer. Mark Rydell, by the way, we haven't said his name yet. He was the director of the film. He did The Rose, I think, before this, and The River in the 80s, and also did that James Dean TV movie with James Franco. He's done a lot of other things, but this is probably the most famous thing he ever did. Well, maybe The Rose for some people with Bette Midler. Credler. But yeah, you got the art imitating life deal and Jane and Henry making up at the end. Jane's told the story many times, so I think it is true to say that that was a healing thing for them as people. It's probably the most personal scene that either of them ever played. And in the moment where she says, I want to be your friend, and reaches out and touches his arm, he says, you come around more often, mean a lot to your mother. And as he does, he's looking down, you see him just start to wipe his eyes, and the camera cuts back to her. I heard he was crying. This is not a guy that I think ever cried on screen, and probably didn't cry much in reality either. He's from that old school. Men don't cry. But his daughter touching him and this moment that actually is about them and these characters, I guess, was a healing moment for him. I don't know how long he cried. It might have just been some manly tears and then, okay, let's go on with the scene.
He could have also been acting, but I think a lot of people, as they get older, say that you become more emotional. Your emotions are closer to the surface the older you get. So how do you feel about the conflict between Chelsea and Norman? Well, just Chelsea's conflict in general, that she can't seem to forgive him and she's so mad at him.
We've been mad at each other for so long. I can relate to it with my dad. We've talked about that in some other podcasts that have these kinds of father-son or father-daughter relationship type films. She does her Footloose-esque angry swimming after Ethel slaps her.
Yeah, what the hell? She just jumps in the lake. It's a weird reaction.
So how do I feel about it? She's got a bit of a sucky face about it.
Yeah.
She's not sucking face. She's sucky-faced. But I guess I can relate to it mostly.
I'm torn about how to feel, especially about the scenes with her and Ethel. Because Ethel is admonishing her for holding a grudge against her father. And on one hand, Ethel's right. Chelsea isn't doing herself any favors by remaining mad and blaming her father for her problems as an adult. But on the other hand, Chelsea's very much right. Norman's an asshole. Why should she go out of her way to spend time with him? He hurt her. He doesn't seem in the least bit sorry. I don't blame her for being extra hurt when she sees that he's in fact capable of patience and kindness for Billy that he wasn't capable of having for her. And she says what probably a lot of daughters have thought, especially only children, he wishes I was a son. He wishes that I was a boy.
Right, and down maybe to he him. Did. Yeah, right down to him saying, Chelsea, we should get back. Chelsea, I'm Billy. It's actually reversed in that moment because he's thinking it's a daughter, but it's really a soon-to-be grandson.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But same kind of idea. Why aren't you not who I think you're supposed to be?
And when she makes up with him, it's entirely her own impetus. He doesn't really do anything to meet her halfway.
Right down to not knowing who she went to Europe with.
Yeah. Well, that's because...
Oh, Bill!
That's because he's going senile. But yeah, she does it for herself. So that she won't suffer regret when he's gone, because he's so clearly near the end of his life and she doesn't want to miss the chance. But I didn't feel very much catharsis for that reconciliation at the end. And I kind of get very frustrated with Ethel because I think we also know someone in our family who is somebody who's been putting up with someone's bad behavior for so long that they then get mad at other people for not also putting up with that bad behavior.
Why can't you tolerate it if I can?
Yeah, if I've been putting up with it this much for this long.
But you're choosing to.
Can't you put up with it for my sake? And it's like, you shouldn't be putting up with it. But that's a very hard thing to say to somebody who's literally spent their life putting up with it.
Or a big chunk of their life, at least. Mm-hmm. We won't explain who those people are because that's getting a little too personal. I don't want to start crying in this podcast. Reach out for my arm. I do have some fun stuff to bring up. Not really reasonably good questions, but well, maybe it is. Chelsea and the guys arrive after dark in the summer in the Northeast. How late did they have that cake?
Good point.
They go swimming. There's the conversation between Bill Ray and Norman. A lot of other things are happening. And then they have the celebratory cake. And it's already been dark. It's got to be 10:30, 11, maybe even midnight by the time this happens.
We know from living around that same, what's the word, latitude? In the summer, the sun doesn't really go down until after 9 o'clock
at night. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It can still be sort of bright at 9:30, even 10.
Yes.
I think we're south, actually, of Maine and New Hampshire and all
that. Yeah, I think you're right. So it would be even more extreme for them.
Where we live in southern Ontario is barely north of the north part of California. People always think of us as the Great White North, even where we live.
Now we have one finger that comes down, right, basically, where a lot of Canadians live.
It's south of a lot of major American cities, like Minnesota, for one, and I think maybe even New York, right around the same latitude anyway. It's a small cast. Hepburn is top billed. She was the bigger star, I guess, between her and Fonda, even after all these years. We covered her on Bringing Up Baby, The Philadelphia Story, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. A lot of movies we've done with her. It's the first time in a long time, though. She only made two more movies after this. The last one was Love Affair with Beatty and Benning. And she lived a lot longer than Fonda did, too. Fonda really did die faster than Hepburn, storyline and reality. He was dead within about a year of this movie, and she lived until, I think, 2004. And I'm guessing her character would live a lot longer than him as well, because she's younger. They even say that. I think she's supposed to be 70 and he's 80.
Wasn't she like one of his students? Wasn't that implied that that's how they met?
He was a teacher too. Let's not forget that. Here's another thing about this movie. You got the former teacher who gets to teach again with Billy. He was doing a lot of shit in the 70s. I was looking up his resume. As many classics as he was in the 30s and 40s and 50s and maybe even the 60s. By the 70s, he was in, I think, three disaster type movies. He was in The Swarm. Which was one of those spin-off type movies of something like Jaws or even a play on the Poseidon Adventure. Let's have this big cast type thing where a disaster happens and our disaster is an animal or a bunch of animals. So he ended on the right note. Thank God he didn't end on some awful movie and that was the last one, although that's really what happens more often than not. Burt Lancaster's last big screen movie was Field of Dreams. He did some TV stuff after that, but what a great way for him to go out, too.
I'll say two things, though. One, nobody knows when their last movie
of course
is going to be. And two, nobody sets out to make a bad movie. So you kind of have to be forgiving of people whose legacy is maybe
exactly.
Not
same amazing. Same with athletes. Most of them don't go out on a great high note, winning the Super Bowl or an MVP award or something like that. More often than not, the legends like Nolan Ryan go out with their shoulder hanging because it's blown out and he's 45 years old and that's the last time he ever pitches in his life. People don't want to remember that and they don't. They remember his great career. Dabney Coleman does play Bill Ray. He was in 9 to 5 as the bad guy with Jane the year before this movie in 1980. Did War Games, a lot of TV. His resume is more TV than anything else. He's a good actor, but you don't really see him in that many movies. Christopher Rydell, the director Mark's son, and Troy Garrity, or Jarrity? Garrity? Jane's son, play the two kids in the dock.
Cool.
And of course, you got the male dude. What's his name again? I didn't write his name down.
Charlie,
of course.
Charlie. It's Catherine Hepburn, Charlie. Right. Just makes me think of the African Queen.
Of course, yeah. Mr. Old Nut. That's the cast. The writer, we didn't say his name, we should have, Ernest Thompson. He was an actor first, and this was his very first screenplay based on his own play. And it won the Oscar. He was the other one that won that night in 1982 for the 81 movies. Pretty good script, I think, right?
Oh, yeah, I think it's wonderful. Like we said, that language is very natural. There's enough conflict to keep it afloat, even though there doesn't seem to be any major main conflict. It accomplishes something that I think is really hard to pull off.
He captures older people for someone who was pretty young at the time. The movie's 185:1. We watched the DVD. It's non-anamorphic, so we had to blow it up to fit the screen, and it was a little spotty. It might have been spotty anyway, but it's a lot more spotty when you blow it up. The cinematographer was Billy Williams, who won an Oscar the year after this for Gandhi, and he was nominated. All the major techs were nominated for this. We'll get to that in a second.
Does make that pond look pretty goddamn gorgeous.
As you point out, it's really a lake, not a pond.
It's not a pond.
Yeah. It is pretty golden. It's a massive lake. Pretty golden, though. The editor, Robert Wolf, cut All the President's Men. He died before the Oscars, but was nominated, and the movie is dedicated to him. And the composer, Dave Grusin worked on Tootsie the year after this and The Goonies in the mid-80s and also had a hand in the music for The Graduate. All right, so here's all the plaudits. Get ready. The movie won the 3 Oscars, actor, actress, and adapted screenplay. It was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Supporting Actress for Fonda, the editing, the cinematography, the sound, and the music. This was a very even year with the Oscars. It was very split up. Chariots of Fire won Best Picture, and it won 4 Oscars. This movie won 3. Reds won 3, including Best Director for Warren Beatty. Raiders of the Lost Ark won 5. That's a big split between those 4 movies, and it's pretty good that they all got so much. I wouldn't have voted for Chariots of Fire if I had a vote.
Would you have voted for this?
I can't say Raiders was the best movie of that year. It's my favorite by a country mile.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites ever.
Everyone's favorite.
Reds is a great film. It's not one you want to watch very often. Great epic. This is a good one, though. If it had won, it's pretty hard to argue against it. So here are the AFI plaudits. We talked about this already, the 4 lists it made. It was 88th on the top 100 quotes with, "You're my knight in shining armor." The whole speech is actually what's referenced there. "Frankly, My Dear, I Don't Give a Damn" was number 1 from Gone with the Wind. Like I said, it outranked on the various lists that it shared with On Golden Pond. On Golden Pond was 45th on the top 100 cheers. "It's Wonderful Life" was number 1. 24th on the top 25 music scores. Did that surprise you?
Your face. Look at me waiting for me to look aghast.
I was surprised. It's a nice score, but
it's so forgettable.
There are so many great ones that have been overlooked were overlooked in that.
It's like a TV movie score. Okay, better than a TV movie score, but certainly not that much more inspired.
Why didn't that list have 100 movies?
Because you have to have like a memorable tune or repeated theme to even begin to consider the score great.
Magnificent Seven is on that list, I'm pretty sure, and I think even highly ranked. And most people know that music, even if they haven't seen that movie.
You play film fans a bit of the score from On Golden Pond, they are not going to be able to identify the movie.
And it's supposed to enhance the movie, not be outside of the movie. But when you talk about the greatest of all time, they kind of are outside the movie. Look at Star Wars. Look at Jaws. Anyway, Star Wars was number 1 on that top scores list. On Golden Pond was 22nd on the top 100 passions. That's a nice one. I was mildly surprised
when
I saw that
list. Who's passionate in that movie? What's the passion?
The old people.
For each other?
They suck face.
It's clear they're in love. It's actually one of the best things that is illustrated in the film is the true love and long-term affection that they have for one another.
That's probably why I made it then.
I guess, but I wouldn't call it passionate. Just saying. Carry on.
Casablanca, we talked about earlier in the podcast, was number 1. And On Golden Pond was nominated for the top 100 quotes with "The loons, they're welcoming us back." Again,
I guess.
Who's ever going to quote that? The Knight in Shining Armor speech? Okay. I would have put it on that list, but I can see that one.
It's a charming moment, but it's not a quotable line.
So it was our coming attractions trivia with the Gone with the Wind answer, but the quotes, the cheers, the scores, and the passions, you're saying no to the music scores. I agree. You're saying no to the passions. Yep. I'm okay with that one, although 22nd is too high. Cheers? Yeah, okay, fine. It's inspirational, and I can live with that quote. But really, if it was on none of those lists, I would have been fine with that, too.
Maybe cheers. No, even then is what I'm saying it out loud.
They need it's pretty inspirational, one of those make up with your kid kind of thing.
They need a new category for like heartwarmingness, and then it would be in the top 20.
I think Cheers was mostly that. It's Wonderful Life is a great example.
That's true.
Because It's a Wonderful Life is inspirational, but is it the most inspirational movie of all time? I don't know, but when you call it, what'd you just say? What was it?
Heartwarming.
Heartwarming. Probably, yeah.
Yeah. Moving.
So you hadn't seen this movie before. I wanted to see it at the end of the summer, I think last year, because it would have been... No, it would have been 2 years ago, because that would have been an anniversary. It would have been... How many years? I can't do the math. 35 years, I guess, at that point?
And it's such a summertime movie. We're watching in November.
But the AFI loved it, and I thought you might like it. I really wanted you to see it. We were actually going to cover, around now, I guess, but we didn't do it, The Oxbow Incident, Henry Fonda film, another social justice movie. Maybe we'll still watch it. Very short. The only nomination it got from the Oscars, Best Picture. And it's all about an unjust lynching. So we did this instead, kind of a polar opposite in a lot of ways type of movie, where he's this irascible old coot. No. Anyway, your last thoughts on A Golden Pond, which I enjoyed an awful lot. I'll watch it again one of these days, although it'd be nice if I could get a Blu-ray, I suppose, that doesn't have to be blown up on the screen because it didn't look very good.
Yeah. Well, it's a rare movie that's this straightforwardly sentimental that will win me over, but here we are. I think it has the acting to thank, but also a fearlessness about letting the characters be flawed and make mistakes. And this would be a pretty easy recommend for any classics fans. I also have to note that probably it worked better on us, or particularly me, because where it was shot in New Hampshire, the area is strikingly similar to cottage country here in Ontario, even down to the pair of loons on the lake. So for me, at least, it immediately conjures a lifetime's worth of memories and positive associations.
Mark Rydell tells a story in the making of with this movie. That when they screened it for Henry, he was pretty sick. He was getting sicker. And he walked over to Rydell, and he stumbled as he got close to him, and he said something like, it's wonderful, it's perfect, it's whatever it was, it means a lot to me, great moment of my life, something like that. And Rydell said, well, it was the greatest moment of my life, that he said that to him. Not that he made the movie necessarily, or that he made this movie that the guy liked, but that he felt that way about the movie that was made. Oh my
God, cue the strings. It's happening. Mm. My heart's bursting again.
And this is a guy, Henry Fonda, who couldn't watch himself on screen after doing 12 Angry Men, which is why he didn't produce anymore. He couldn't watch rushes and then cuts as they came in, the fine cut, the final cut, and all that kind of thing, because he couldn't take seeing himself on screen. But obviously this one time, he must have liked it pretty well.
Had to watch his daughter on screen.
Pretty heartwarming stuff. I thought when we watched it, I was going to break out, actually, because Fox was still alive at this point, but yeah, he was getting close to the end.
Yeah, it's true.
I think it was only a few days before we put him down, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly when we watched it, but I remember he was a very sick dog. He had spent the day in my lap when we transferred him to your lap.
For the whole movie, yeah.
Yeah, and then he just sat with you in his blanket.
He never didn't move out of my lap for two hours. In that case, he didn't move.
Very peppy dog, so yeah.
And I wondered when the movie started, beyond the Fox thing, if I was going to cry during that scene, because it's gotten me before, the one at the end with Jane and Henry making up, but didn't quite get there. But I still think it's a very emotional moment and a great one and a very good movie. Okay, when we return in 7 days, we'll cover our first foreign language film in quite a while, the Italian docudrama by Vittorio De Sica, Bicycle Thieves, which a lot of people would call The Bicycle Thief, and they would be wrong. It is Bicycle Thieves. The coming attractions trivia for Bicycle Thieves. I almost called it The Bicycle Thief there. It was number one on the Sight and Sound poll the very first year that list happened in 1952. Name the other three movies that have ranked number one on either the critics or directors poll in the decades since. So a pretty easy one to find.
And for the answer to that, check out next week's podcast about The Bicycle Thieves. But what if you just can't wait until then? Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com, for more Ryan and Bev. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, you can check out the 275 movies
with
that
just
we have
you and
covered.
Me. There's more than
with
that
just
in
you
total.
And me. There is so much wonderful stuff. And it's all for free, all there for you. But perhaps in exchange, you'd like to give us a rating and a review. Perhaps there's a movie you'd be interested in seeing us cover. And if you mention that in a review, we will definitely seriously consider doing it. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it is not case sensitive.
All right, Sam, you're the mascot now. You can do anything. Fox would have wanted to play with toys by this point. No? Sam Ellis Jr. Norman Thayer Jr. You old poop.
And cut.